All right, folks, welcome to the Eric Anders Lang Show. Today we have a very special guest. It's Lucas Michel, none other than the man who from Australia who played Augusta. Very excited to talk to him about what it's like to play in the Masters. Stuart and Lucas are going to join us here in a minute. I've got some podcast ad reads that I need to get out of the way. Let's see what we got here. You know what? I put them away. Didn't I do that? Yale copy. Here you go. Theragun, folks, feel free to ad lib as I always do. The stress of daily life weighs on us all. Whether you're an elite athlete or just a regular person trying to get through the day, ain't it hard, yo? Muscle pain and muscle tension is a real thing. Here's the thing. I've been using Theragun for a while. I do love it. Theragun.com/Eric. Theragun.com/Eric, E-R-I-K. Yo, get your Gen 4 and, shit, I don't have a discount for you. I'm sorry about that. That's why I use Theragun. Handheld percussive therapy device releases your deepest fears. I mean, muscle tension using a scientifically calibrated combination of depth, speed, power. Oh, I dropped the mic. Anyway, the Gen 4 Theragun proprietary brushes. So it's so quiet. You'll wonder if it's even on. It'll confuse you. Check those y'alls out. Anyone here? No, we don't have any. No one else here but me. Blah, blah. LinkedIn Talent Solutions, folks. Thanksgiving edition. All right. So anyway, LinkedIn's an active community of professionals with more than 706 million members worldwide. That's a lot of people. That's a tremendously large amount of people. Getting started is easier than ever. Yo, you want a job? Go to LinkedIn. Check out the LinkedIn Jobs platform. And what do you think? I've actually used LinkedIn to hire people and I think it worked out. I mean, either way, it's super legit and easy to use. Manage job posts from a single view. All right, folks, here's the main deal. You want to get $50 off as a business, ready to make that next hire? Find the right person on LinkedIn Jobs. Go to linkedin.com/Eric to get $50 off. You're going to go to linkedin.com/Eric, $50 off. Terms and conditions apply, which means you got to be awesome. As always, regular series podcast partners. We've got Jones Golf Bags up there in Portland, Oregon. We've got TaylorMade Golf Clubs. Obviously, if you like Tiger, you like TaylorMade. We've got Vice Golf Balls. I don't have any here with me right now, but and then we also have Precision Pro, the range finder to find where you want to go, where you want to go. Where you want to go? Where do you want to go? Go, go. And then we also have, whoop straps, y'all. Get your whoop strap. I think the code's EAL. Man, we got a bunch of fun stuff coming up here. I don't know when this ad's going to air. It'll really air right away. Lucas, how have you been, man? Have you been up to much since we saw you last? Have you done anything wild or interesting?
Nothing too interesting. When was that? December?
It was December. Year. Yeah, it was like President's Cup time. We played a quick round of golf and then what happened? Yeah. You were in Australia and then what?
So I went from, obviously that week I went and played Augusta the following week for practice rounds. So yeah, I pretty much had the best sort of lead up to Christmas ever. Went and played Augusta, played it like four or five times in the trip. I was there for 3 days. And then Christmas and then sort of summer and played a bunch of tournaments. And then COVID.
Wait, you flew up in December to get a practice round for the Masters. For everybody that doesn't know, mm-hmm. check out our YouTube video. You know, you talked a little bit about winning the mid-am and essentially, you know, that means you're going to play Augusta, which you didn't quite realize that immediately. Your caddy realized that before you.
I knew, but it was never really, I never really thought it was realistic. Like I was excited. I was going to turn pro like the week after the mid-am. Obviously, assuming I wouldn't win. That was the plan. And then, so when I won, I was like, oh my God, this completely changes everything for me. And it really was life changing. Like I went from, you know, wondering what I was going to do with golf to having starts in two of the biggest events in the world, two majors. So yeah, it was a completely life changing moment. And then, so when I saw you, I was about to go to Augusta to play some practice visits and sort of scout the course, because I felt like if I could see the course early, then I could work on my game between then and then in April. But I ended up having a lot more months to work on my game and try and fine tune it for Augusta.
So you basically left to go to the States in December and you just are getting home.
Yeah. Yeah. So I left in December and then I returned home to Australia, played the summer of golf in Australia. And then I actually went back over to the States in March prepping for Augusta. And I got there like March 11. And that was the day they canceled or postponed the NBA. And then the following day was the day they canceled the Players Championship through one round. And then the following day I was on a plane to Augusta and I got an email from the chairman saying that the tournament was going to be postponed. So I was legitimately flying to Augusta when I got that email. So I knew at that point that I would be only probably spending a few more days in America, and I had to hop on a plane home and get home to safety pretty much. So it was a whirlwind of sort of week of thinking I'm going to be playing the Masters in 3 weeks' time to knowing that I'm going home to a lockdown and a quarantine and everything like that.
But did you actually fly? I thought you stayed. Didn't you stay in the US for a while?
So this more recent trip, yes. I ended up going home to Oz in lockdown for 8 or 9 weeks, I think it was. Basically, I didn't play golf for 8 or 9 weeks. So I was hitting into a little net in my backyard. Had a TrackMan, which was like probably the most expensive thing in my house. So I was hitting balls into a net, practicing, working on my game, but I wasn't able to play golf for 8 or 9 weeks.
That's not good.
Yeah.
That would be good for like me. Yeah. Stuart, you would be good for that, Stu. Like you, I feel like you play well when you haven't played after a while.
I do too. One question I've got is like, what was the kind of emotions like going from, like Augusta, all that, and then obviously the uncertainty. Everyone was dealing with uncertainty at that time, but you had the greatest year, every golfer's dream year planned out. And then next minute you're in your backyard in Melbourne hitting golf balls into a net.
Yeah. I think I knew eventually everything was going to be great. Like I knew eventually I was going to play the Masters and play the US Open. I knew it was going to come at some point. I just had to be patient. So I definitely wasn't too down or, you know, depressed or anything like that. I was still excited for everything that was to come, but I also, obviously I was a little bit sort of not sure about the future as well. But I think I dealt with it pretty well. It was when it became difficult was when they re-announced the schedule, and then I had to figure out how I was going to get to the US because flights out of Australia were really restricted. And then I realized I ended up going for the US Amateur and then US Open and Masters. And that was a 4 month stretch, but I needed to get a visa because I was there for more than 90 days. And so that was another stressful thing, trying to get a visa at the last minute because all the consulates are closed. You had to get like an emergency appointment and it was just a massive nightmare, but I ended up getting it all. And I eventually did get over the US. And
what did you like when you were going to get the appointment? Were you like, I'm playing in the Masters, and they're like, what are you talking about? You're like, this is the only thing that matters to most people that play golf. Did they get it?
I think what ended up happening, I knew someone who worked in the government in Australia, and they kind of directly contacted the consulate for me. If I went through the normal channels, it would have been really hard for me to actually get on a plane and go. But thankfully I knew someone in the right position. So I was really lucky, knowing that, but, I think it was obviously a fair thing for me to be able to travel. Obviously the Masters and the US Open are two pretty big tournaments once I kind of put my applications through, they got approved pretty quickly. And that was a massive relief for me.
I can see that visa interview happening right now. When the guy says, so what's your purpose for visiting the US? And I'm going to play in the Masters. And the guy goes, this guy's clinically insane. Denied.
That's
the best was when I actually arrived back in Oz. I was I came down through the doors downstairs at the hotel quarantine, and they were assigning me a room, and there was two Aussie police officers doing it. And they knew I was in the US, and they asked, "Oh, did you see any of the Masters last week?" And I had to tell the guy that I played it, and he was loving that. So we had a good chat after that.
But he probably couldn't believe it.
No. I think he kind of like was a little bit struck at first, and then we had a good chat though. They love their golf, and they're really nice guys. Everyone's been so nice here, with checking in and stuff like that, because it's a tricky situation, you know. That I'm sure there's a lot of upset people that they're having to deal with, but everyone who's sort of doing this process, they're really, really good at it, really happy, and you know, it's been really smooth. But it's obviously not an ideal position to be in for me, sitting in a hotel for 2 weeks.
I wonder if you almost need some alone time for 2 weeks to really sit, collect your thoughts, and actually appreciate the 4 months that you've just experienced, I suppose. Because it's when you experience something like that, I don't know how it would quite sink in what has just happened. So you can sit there in your room and
I think you're right.
Do you ever sit in your room and just have a little wry smile to yourself when a little memory comes up?
Yeah, for sure. I've actually sort of been, I've been making sure I write everything down that happened, so it really does sink in. Because everything that happened in the last 4 months, it'd be easy to forget, the little funny details of it all. So I've been sort of reflecting on it, writing a little bit, and it's sort of journaling. It's been a really cool ride.
When you say everything that's happened, I want to spend some time on that. We'll get into the experience of, you know, what was it like, you know, walking into Augusta with like a glove and a lanyard that says, "I'm here to not only play golf." Most people that are, you know, we know, talk to, just are lucky enough to play as a guest. You know, you obviously highest level of competition, one of the coolest amateur places that you can have, but we'll get into that. But when you say all of the things that happened, do you have a stat really briefly to give everybody just a flash? Like, how many top 100 courses have you played in the last 150 days? Like, it's up. I was watching you and I was just like, dang, he just keeps knocking them down. Like, what how do you top it each day?
Yeah. So I've been on the Golf Magazine top 100 panel for like 12 months now. And whenever I'd travel, I'd always try and seek out great golf courses, because obviously I've got a keen interest in golf course architecture, and just something I've always loved to do, play great golf courses, particularly obviously coming from the Melbourne Sandbelt where I live now. It's like, almost anything pales in comparison to some of the golf we have down here. So whenever I go abroad, I try and match that. But, so I ended up playing, I really need to do a tally, but I'm not really a massive sort of list guy in terms of like checking off lists, but I mean, I played the 5 courses at Bandon, so there's 5. but I also went to Boston. I was in San Francisco for a few days. I played like San Francisco Golf Club. And it would have to be around 20 of the top US top 100, I would guess. I did a Boston trip, a Philly trip. And then it was kind of like Pinehurst and Charlotte and Winston-Salem, and sort of there was like a bunch of different spots that
what was the worst course?
worst course? Augusta.
What was the worst course, and what was your worst round?
The worst round I played was at Pine Valley. I did not play very well at all, so that was straight after the US Open. I think I was mentally fragile from the US Open, and then Pine Valley is probably one of the most penal golf courses you could imagine. Like, if you miss the fairway, you're just like hacking out of weeds and trees, and it's no good. So, I was mentally fragile from the US Open, from getting my butt kicked there. And then I rolled into Pine Valley and I think I shot about 80, which was pretty poor, but you know, it was still Pine Valley, and Pine Valley is an awesome golf course. Well, I still enjoyed it.
That's what I was going to ask there. Did it at all dampen your experience of Pine Valley?
I mean, I think everyone's going to be a little bit dampened if they play poorly at a golf course. They're never going to probably see it for all it's worth. But I try and disconnect from how I play to how I enjoy the day, and I still had a great time.
It's hard to do. It's hard to do. It's very hard to separate the experience from the score. And
yeah,
if it was easy,
I think when you're on a panel, it's pretty important to, like, if you're a panelist for those golf courses, you really have to try to do that. Like you're saying, like, really dissociate the experience in the golf course.
Yeah. It's like, especially for a panelist, I mean, how do you give it a fair shake? I mean, you've got so many factors, whether the sleep you got, you know, whether or not the, like, pizza is, like, making you have gas, whatever, you know what I mean? Like, there's so many, like, I mean, for me, you know, but, like, there's so many things that, like, right.
I played up in Boston at Essex County Club, which is, like, a really nice golf course, kind of like no one really knows about. It's off the beaten track, but a really good Donald Ross golf course. And it rained the whole day. I think we got like 2 inches of rain while I was playing, and everything was soaked. Everything was like, it was horrible. I played like poorly, and still I was like, this is like one of the best golf courses I've ever played. So sometimes the weather can add to it and make it even more memorable in a way. Like, I will never forget the day I played at Essex County Club just because of how ridiculous the weather was. But I definitely didn't feel like, I think I was able to sort of separate the weather from the golf course. And I really enjoyed the golf course for what it was. I thought it was awesome.
I understand that completely. When my dad and I played Lost Farm down in Tasmania one time, I played it a bunch of times. And my favorite time ever was when there was 50 kilometer an hour winds. The ball was going sideways. You couldn't, you know, and it was one of those memorable days. Where had you based yourself in the US? So were you flying from you were in one spot and you were flying to these places for a week at a time, or how were you navigating that?
Yeah, I was lucky. Like, I obviously know a lot of people in the US, but for the most part, I was staying in Michigan because I was doing like an internship with Mike DeVries, the golf course architect. So he designed Cape Wickham and Kingsley Club up in Michigan, and he's done a bunch of really good courses. So he was working on a golf course in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. When I was there, I was in the States for, 12, 14 weeks, something like that. For about 7 or 8 of them, I was in Bloomfield Hills. So just really kind of getting some on the ground experience of what golf course architecture and construction really entails. And I found it really interesting. And on top of that, I had a golf course that I could play and practice at. Bloomfield Hills is really good, and they were kind of staging the works, so there was always holes that were open that I could hit balls or practice on. So it was a really good spot to base myself for the majority of the trip.
You seen anything different up there? Like, kind of, I mean, I guess in a sense, the landscape of it, Bloomfield Hills, where is that near? Is that kind of in the, where
Detroit,
is that?
Detroit, sort of.
Detroit.
Yeah. Probably 20 minutes from Detroit. Yeah. The land's awesome there in Bloomfield Hills. And you've obviously got Oakland Hills, which is like literally just around the corner. But then I went up on the weekends with Mike, and we went up and played like Crystal Downs and Kingsley Club, which are up in northern Michigan. And those places are like honestly so sweet. Northern Michigan is probably one of the most beautiful places in the world. Like Sleeping Bear Sand Dunes, we went there. There's a 450 foot high sand dune that just comes straight off Lake Michigan, and it's one of the most incredible things you'll ever see. Honestly, Northern Michigan is stunning.
Does it remind you at all of your sand belt, maybe, but adding some hills?
Definitely, like the land's like similar. It's probably just a bit more dramatic and beautiful. Like the sand belt, I wouldn't call the sand belt golf courses like pretty or like super pretty because of the landscape or anything like that. Like, they're beautiful inside the fences, but I mean, Crystal Downs, you've got views of Crystal Lake and Lake Michigan, and Kingsley Club's this sort of really open rolling terrain in like the middle of a forest. So like, they're very different, I'd say, but you know, they've both kind of got their own beauties about them, I suppose.
What was Mike's opinion of, is it the fourth hole of Crystal Downs or the fifth, the one with the huge mound and you can't even figure out what to do, kind of like a dog leg left, short par four.
That one. Something. Yeah, I mean, Mike is a member at Crystal Downs. So, And he, Mike's got a really long history with Crystal Downs. His family's been going up there to that area for, you know, 100 years, three generations or whatever it is, four generations. So his family's got a house up there, and he's been a member there for maybe 20 years. And he actually worked at the golf course in the bag room from the age of 14 till 17. And then he worked on the grounds crew from 17 through college. So if there's anyone that's going to tour me around Crystal Downs, it would probably be Mike DeVries, because there's no one better to that knows the place. So he just adores the place, and so much of his work and his architecture, I think, is inspired by what's on the ground at Crystal Downs. I mean, Kingsley Club and Crystal Downs definitely have a lot in common, just in the green complexes and the way that the golf courses just feel and how they're routed. And yeah, it's I mean, he just adores the place. And yeah, you're right. The fifth hole with that kind of ridgeline running through it, that's sort of one of the best short par fours going around. So
yeah, it's crazy. It's one of these holes, Stuart. It's like if someone made this hole today, you'd be like, get out of here. Like it's like they took like a building, turned it on its side and poured grass all over it. And you're just staring at this big mound with no indication of anything, of where to go, where to hit your tee shot, where the next shot goes. And it's like, it's absurd. The
ultimate puzzle.
Yeah.
Ultimate puzzle. Yeah. I mean, that's
when I first played it.
Sorry, New Orleans.
No, go on.
I was going to say it's a Mackenzie design, isn't it?
Yeah, Mackenzie and Perry Maxwell.
Right.
Yeah. So Perry Maxwell was the American guy on the ground, I think, doing a lot of the work as well. So Perry did Prairie Dunes as well, and Old Town Club. I got down to Old Town Club in North Carolina when I was there, and that place is sweet too. So, and I think Perry Maxwell did a bit of the work at Augusta too. I might be wrong. I probably should know that, but I think he did some of the later work at Augusta after Mackenzie left.
I don't know. I don't know. Stu, should we go? You must have 1,000 questions. I feel like you have more questions about Augusta than I do.
I am like, I'm just waiting to pop. I'm like,
just go.
Just bring us on Augusta, please.
Just go, Stu. Just walk us through. By the way, Lucas, Stuart and I went to Augusta together, and here's the irony is we only had one ticket. And so I went in, I gave him the ticket, and he went in, and we both just hooked up later, and we were both like, yeah, we both cried. And then we experienced it together, but not actually together.
Yeah, someone had kind of said,
yeah,
it was almost like someone said to me, are you all right, mate? I was like, I'm fine. I'm in Augusta.
You're like, you it's just found a guy with curly hair, and you were like, can you just hang out next to me for a second?
We always actually say it because we got in on the Friday, but we don't have a picture together in Augusta. I remember that. What was the your experience of like the first time you got to Augusta? I'll never forget my first experience, but when you're there to play it, it's funny because it's a completely different environment to when the Masters is on.
Yeah, so I went, like I said before, I went in December in 2019, and it was really unique because as a player, you can play there unaccompanied. And so you're not with a member, and you can basically play by yourself with you know, a caddy and just you and the caddy. So my first experience of Augusta, I remember, you know, you go down Magnolia Lane and then you kind of get to the end of that road and it opens up. And that's really when it like first sort of hits you. I mean, the gates and stuff are cool and the drive's really awesome. But when it opens up and you see like the flowers, the pin and the grass and the clubhouse, that's when it really becomes real. And then I remember I went off just after there was some members there, and I went off just after them with the assistant pro, who was a really good guy, and we just played. And I wasn't worrying about score at all. I was just like, I'm going to enjoy Augusta for Augusta National. I'm not thinking about score. I'm just playing golf, enjoying the experience. But I do remember birdieing the first hole, so that was a bit of a highlight. But yeah, it was just an awesome, awesome first experience of the golf course. But it was probably the second day that I was there that was maybe like the most sort of spiritual, because I went out there, I was the first group out, it was foggy, like when I teed off, and then I was walking down the second fairway and the sun had just lifted above the horizon. It was shining through the trees. the dew and the fog was lifting off the grass, and I was just walking down the fairway just by myself with the caddy, 50 yards ahead of me. And I remember just looking down there, I'm like, oh my God, I've never seen anything like this. I took a photo of the scene. I had my camera on me, and then that's been my phone background, my computer background. It's been the background of everything since. So that was probably, that walk down the second hole, that second time I played, it was probably the real cool moment I've had at Augusta.
Can we see that photo? Can you show us your phone screen?
Yeah.
Do you have it?
Yeah, I could. Yeah, I got it right here.
Let's see this.
Let me just say.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Incredible. That's number two?
Yeah.
You're going
That's black, number two it? Walking down the fairway. That's my caddy.
Did you, did you just take that on your phone?
There's the entrance to the green now.
No, I had a camera with me. It's just like a old DSLR camera, but yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. Yeah.
It looks, two, so that just doesn't look real.
Two and eight are some really incredible holes, aren't they, Lucas?
Yeah. Yeah. Two and eight, they go sort of side by side. Two par fives, obviously they play very different because one's uphill, one's downhill. But I mean, that golf course is packed full of great golf holes. It's crazy. Everyone thinks of Augusta and they think of how perfectly conditioned it is and all that. And to be fair, like the Masters, it wasn't in perfect shape, but it's still an incredible golf course.
Eric and I kind of spoke about this during last week. We caught up and I had watching the Masters, obviously, and I'd had this realization that he had played there and I'd thought about it. It was all cool and everything, but watching the Masters again, and I think Eric posted a picture on his phone from like the 13th hole or whatever, and I just kind of had a moment of thought that it must be so weird being in a place that you know so well, but the actual playing of it is completely different. So when you're standing on those fairways and you're hitting those shots, what's that feeling like? Like the first time, like you say, walking down number two, everyone knows number two. You're at the top of the hill and you're just walking down towards that beautiful green stuff.
Yeah.
And when you're actually putting yourself in a position to play the shots that you've watched your entire life, that not many people get to experience, what's that like?
It can be overwhelming. I remember the night before, Sunday night in the Crow's Nest, I stayed one night before the tournament in the Crow's Nest. They were restricting only one person per night in the Crow's Nest, which is a little bit disappointing because I would have stayed there a bit more. But so Sunday night before the tournament, I was there and they were playing. They had on the TV, you could watch any of the official films of the Masters from, 1958 or whatever year they started doing them. And so I started watching them, and then because I was watching them and I was getting so engaged with them, I could feel myself starting to think too much about the week ahead. Like, I could see myself hitting the shot on 18 or hitting this shot on there and this shot there. And I started actually getting like really nervous about the week ahead. And so I actually had to turn it off because I was like, I'm going to overthink this and just kind of get completely in awe of the fact that I'm here. And I had to try and remember that I've actually here to play a golf tournament and play good golf and obviously still enjoy the experience, but I'd probably enjoy it more if I wasn't worrying too much about how I was going to score. So, and that sort of happened as well. That happened before, obviously during April, a lot of the television, I mean, I know in Australia, Fox Sports in Australia, which is our sports sort of cable channel, we did like Masters week. And so they played official films of the Masters like the whole week. And I started watching it. I was like, oh, this is awesome. And then I just found myself so enthralled by the Masters. And I started building it up so much in my mind about how big of a tournament and thing it is to be playing the Masters that I actually had to stop watching and just be like, no, just push that out of your mind and just focus on playing golf. And so that was kind of something I had to be cautious of, getting too wrapped up in the fact that I was playing the Masters where, all these incredible golfers and history had taken place, and just sort of realized that, I still want to play great. And if I want to do that, I've probably got to, try and get that out of my mind a little bit.
that would be the hardest thing, right? I mean, it's like you've grown up wanting to go to Disneyland mm-hmm. your entire life, and then you finally get to go to Disneyland and they hand you like a work uniform and go, okay, go to work. And then you're like walking past yeah. all the rides. You're walking past yeah. all the rides going, I really want to go on those rides, but at the end of the day, I'm here yeah. to work, realistically.
That was the good thing about the early visits that I did. I could do that. The visit in December and when I was there in March, I really could enjoy it for what it was. But then when it came to that night in the crow's nest and I started watching the tapes, I was like, you've enjoyed Augusta. Let's actually try and take this, you know, a little more seriously. So I kind of did both, but I still at the same time tried my best to have a really fun week at the tournament. And I've got the fondest memories of it, even though I probably didn't play as well as I'd hoped.
What, as far as you played in what is going to be like one of the like most unusual Masters ever, right? Like it's never, we don't know, yeah, I guess, yeah. but it's so bizarre for so many reasons. I was thinking about the lack of fans, the lack of patrons must have created some opportunities for you to really, I would imagine, have like a, it was probably maybe more dreamlike. You probably had more time to like connect with your, you know, playing partners. Was there a takeaway that yeah. you saw that I just couldn't see? Because from my perspective, watching it on TV, and you know, maybe people aren't going to like me saying this, but it was missing something, and that yeah. was an interesting learning experience for me, because what it was missing was missing like in a way the golf patrons, the golf fans, the golf world. We almost, having us at Augusta for the Masters seemed to be the completion of the story. It's like, I need to see people there because that's the pilgrimage. That's how much it means. I don't care at the players. I don't care if anyone's at the players. Mm. Like, I just want to see him go in the water on 17 or make a hole in one. But at Augusta, yeah. it meant so much more. So was there any experience for you where you saw something that just no one would have ever seen?
Yeah, I mean, overall, I'd say the players in general were way more, way less stressed and more open. So like, you know, if you wanted to chat to them, they were, you know, way more accepting of conversation than probably normal. Like just without crowds and without having to, you know, wade through crowds and autographs and all that, I think in general, they were really enjoying it, the pros. And so when I played with guys, like, so I played practice rounds with Xander Schauffele and Max Homa and Patrick Cantlay, and that was really cool. I played in a foursome with them, and they were so nice. I mean, Max Homa is the funniest, nicest guy ever. Xander's awesome. Patrick's so cool. So like, it was the most fun sort of grouping I could have had. And the Xander and Patrick pulled out after 9, and so it was just myself and Max Homa. And it's Max's first Masters as well. It was actually his first time there playing the golf course. So to share that experience with someone else that was going through the same emotions and same sort of things that I was really, really cool. Yeah. So that, I really enjoyed that aspect of it. Obviously, without the patrons, it definitely didn't feel... the stage didn't feel as big. So I probably wasn't as nervous as I would be, you know, real Masters, you know, real kind of authentic experienced Masters. But it still was, it was cool in its own ways. I mean, the access that I had on Saturday, I had to finish up my second round. So just checkbox, I did make the weekend at Augusta. So I played 3 holes on Saturday. I had to finish up 3 holes, and then I was like, what am I going to do for the rest of the day? So I went out with my caddy and coach, and we just went and watched, and that was awesome. That was like, imagine the Masters, but you're the only spectators. And they actually still had the, like, all the food and beverage going as well, and it was all free. So I just walk in and grab like sandwiches, and they didn't have alcohol, but you know, Sprite and whatever you wanted. And so I was just like lapping it up on Saturday, and literally had a front row seat watching the best players in the world. That was pretty cool.
I kind of battled in my head with, like, obviously every single one of us especially the guys that know you, since we met you in December, we've just been living this year vicariously through you, right? If you're a golf fan, Lucas Michel has had the best year ever. And I was battling through my head, how does Lucas look at this? Is it, this is weird because I'm playing in a Masters with no fans, in a US Open with no fans? Or does he look at it and this is incredible because it's unique. It's one Masters that everyone's going to remember for all time and you can say, I played in that Masters.
Yeah. I don't know how I feel about it yet. I think not knowing what a true sort of authentic Masters experience and US Open experience would have been like, it's hard to say, but there's definitely elements of this one that make it very, very unique to be part of. And certainly one that, I mean, most people won't forget 2020 or no one's going to forget 2020, but most people probably won't forget the 2020 Masters and 2020 US Opens as well, just because that was so different to all the ones that came before them. So yeah, I don't really know how I feel about it. I know that I really would have enjoyed the original scheduling because I was going to have 20 members from my home club, Metropolitan in Melbourne, that were going to be there watching me. I was going to have six or seven mates because you get tickets as a player. I was going to give them to them and we were just going to have an awesome week together. They were going to be my little cheer squad. And then the US Open was going to be really cool because it's in New York and a bunch of my younger friends from Australia were like, let's just do a trip to New York and have fun and we'll go watch Lucas play the US Open. So none of that ended up happening, which was going to still, it was going to really add to the experience of the two majors. So that didn't happen. And obviously you know, that would have been great. But at the same time, you know, the opportunity to work for sort of 6-7 weeks with Mike DeVries and learn a lot more about golf course architecture and construction, and then have a really unique experience at the Masters and US Open that very few people are going to ever have. Yeah, there's pros and cons of both. So yeah, I don't know. I can't really say. I guess time will tell. Hopefully I get to play another authentic Masters and US Open, and then I might have a better way to compare them.
That's a good question, Stu. I like that question. Lucas, I'm curious to know, like, I feel like it's an obvious, like, if you had to choose between, you know, Wingfoot US Open and Augusta for the Masters. So I'm not really interested in asking you that question, but I'm curious to know, like, was there any, like, great takeaway in the difference, right? Because everyone, like, holds the Masters in its own category. And a big part of that obviously is it's at the same course every year, you know, at the court, the course itself, each hole is like a celebrity. They've got names. No one really knows Wingfoot, right? Mm-hmm. Like unless you played it. Mm-hmm. And so, but as far as just the way they go down, the way the players react to it, the way it's not talking about like trash on like the way it's run or like, oh, the USGA did this or that. Just like, it was there actually a difference it between the two, aside from, you know, all those things?
I think there probably is. I think in general, when you get to Augusta, everyone is like in awe of the place. Like everyone is so happy to be there. All the players are like, it really is Disneyland for players. So I think there's definitely that element. I mean, Augusta growing up, watching golf on TV, you know, it's every April you get to see the course. Like you said, you're so familiar with all the golf shots and holes and, like you said, the names of each hole and everything like that. So I think the familiarity with the golf course and just the fact that, you know, it is such an iconic piece of every young up-and-coming golfer's history in golf, sort of watching the Masters. I think there's definitely that greater sense of awe when you go and play Augusta, and then compare that to a US Open at somewhere like Wingfoot, which obviously has a reputation of its own in that it's one of the hardest golf courses, and the rough obviously this year was very, very difficult. So there's probably a higher stress level amongst the players. They're all kind of spending more time around the greens trying to figure out the shots, hitting more shots on in the rough to try and figure out what the rough's doing. They're just kind of probably trying to figure out the golf course a bit more than they were at Augusta, whereas I think at Augusta, everyone feels like they know the course pretty well, even if they haven't really played it. It's kind of just a different sort of thing. So yeah, I think the preparation side of things was very different at Wingfoot. Just everyone was grinding it out, trying to really learn the golf course quickly. And that kind of made it feel a little bit different amongst the players.
Do you think a few players go into the US Open with a sense of fear of the golf course because the media build it up so much every year? So it's always like, this is going to be the toughest, like obviously the depth of the rough and all that sort of stuff. Like, is there a sense of that? People are like, oh, here we go. It's going to be a slog this week.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that's kind of how everyone likes to make out the US Open. And I mean, Wingfoot's a great golf course and it's a really fun golf course, but obviously the US Open with the rough like it is, they definitely set it up in a way that makes it a little scarier than it normally is. But it's an interesting one because the golf courses that I get most scared on are ones where you can lose a golf ball, where you can hit one offline and lose it. And that wasn't really the case at Wingfoot. I mean, you could lose a golf ball easier at Augusta than you could at Wingfoot, which is interesting. I mean, we saw Bryson plug one in the rough, but yeah, there's some areas where you could definitely lose a ball at Augusta, but I think they're just, they're different. There's certainly a little bit more tension and anxiety at a US Open, and some of that is because of how it's built up and its reputation.
How did you prepare for that leading up to that? Because there's not many courses that you'll find short of like Torrey Pines, one I can think of off the top of my head, that you can go off the fairway, drop a ball and try and hit out of that dense rough. Short of obviously having your practice rounds during the week, how did you find a way to prepare for that?
It was quite funny because I spent the weeks in the lead up in Michigan at Bloomfield Hills Country Club. And it was funny because the golf course was being renovated, there was areas on the golf course where they weren't cutting the rough. And so I would just take a cart out to those areas and just drop some balls in there and just start whacking it because it was all bluegrass, the same grass as Wingfoot. So it was actually perfect. So, I mean, it didn't end up really helping me that much, but I did feel like I was a little bit more comfortable in the rough because of that. So that was quite funny.
As far as technique of hitting it out of the rough, what did you come up with? I mean, like, what is the technique? I don't even understand. You put it where? Yeah. What do? You open up the club face?
Especially being the sand. The chipping technique.
No, it's so different to what we get in Melbourne. The chipping technique I found that worked really well was, I mean, I chatted to Curtis Luck about it, and his technique, he's a really good short game player. His technique was just to sort of like throw the club at the ball and just sort of let it stick and stop under the ball and pop out. But I tried that and I just couldn't hit it like that. So I almost did the opposite. I put the ball back in the stance. I kind of opened it up a little bit and made sure I was hitting down on it enough. And then I kind of felt like I was just dragging my body through it, like my torso through the shot, so that I could just get through the thickness of the rough. And that actually worked pretty well. I chipped okay. But yeah, I didn't have a lot of experience out of those.
I saw you hold a couple of those chips.
Oh, yeah. That's true, actually. I did hold those two chips on, what was it, 7 and 12. So that was pretty nice.
So what was the what was the request for the pro shop at Augusta? How many messages did you get? Let's be honest here. Because I thought about messaging you, so I don't even really know you.
In prior trips, I'd accepted some of the requests. And so I'd bought like hats and stuff for my buddies back home. And then this trip, because I was here for 4 months, I had so much luggage. There was just no way I was going to take back any more than I had to. So I just had to tell people, I was like, look, I'm really sorry, but I'm not going to be able to take anything back. But I did.
You're like, I'm not going to be able to take anything back for you.
Weren't allowed in the shop.
But I will be able to sell you some items.
Yeah, exactly. So my coach and caddy weren't allowed in the shop, and it was just players and spouses, I think. So I went in the shop and like raided it for them. And so I'd go in and then they were standing outside and I'd like run in and I'd like look around what's there. And then I'd like come back out and tell them what's there. And then I'd say, yeah, get me this. And then I'd go back in and then pile it up on the counter. And then I'd say, oh, do you want this, this, or this? And so I think I've got a tab there and I need to pay it off. It'd be 95% their stuff, but it went on my tab. So they still have to pay me back. But I'd say it was like $3,000 or $4,000. It was ridiculous. Will, my caddy, bought one of those Scotty Cameron, like, Masters putters, which were like $800. And I mean, you could spend so much money in there.
Can you send me,
and all the stuff's awesome.
When you get the tab, can I see that? Can you forward what does a tab from Augusta National look like? Like, it probably is really old school.
Yeah. It is. They don't even send it by email. They just they mail it to you. Oh, so
when are you gonna get it? By the time you get it, you won't even need to pay.
I've already got one from, I got one from last time, because it's really funny. They'll invoice you things and it'll be like, because you're an amateur, I'm an amateur, they have to invoice you for the Crow's Nest nights. And it's like $8 for like a night in the Crow's Nest. Also like Crow's Nest accommodation. Like,
I was going to say, surely they're like, when they send a tab, surely you think someone, they would go, just leave him off. He's an amateur. He doesn't have any money. Yeah. I'll pick it up.
Yeah. No. I think the rules of amateur status are like, you can't like give this to an amateur because it's like violating the rules. So they like have to put up like a nominal charge of like $6 or $8 or whatever it is. It's really funny.
Lucas, did you ever catch yourself at any point within, first of all, did you leave Augusta the property at all during the Masters? Like, did you basically enter and then just basically leave a week later?
No, because of the Crow's Nest set, normally you'd have five or six amateurs staying in the Crow's Nest, but because of the setup this year with COVID, they only had one. So I was staying the week in Aiken in a house. But it was really cool. It was really cool when you'd obviously stay the night in Augusta at the club, and everyone would leave cabins. But I mean, you feel like you're the only one there. You're definitely the only one in the clubhouse, which is damn cool.
Was that scary? But I mean, like,
not really. I'm not really someone to get spooked out. But when you go up into the Crow's Nest and like you're looking across all the photographs of people that have stayed there, and I mean, many of them have passed. I mean, I'm sure that it feels like there's some ghosts up there for some people. But I mean, I just loved it. I mean, the photos. I slept under a photograph of Ben Crenshaw, which is awesome, and I saw him. I actually drove past him one of the days. I didn't get to meet him, but I wanted to tell him about that.
Mate, if there are any ghosts at Augusta, they'll not spend their time in the Crow's Nest. I'll give you the hot tip. They're out on the golf course.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, I have two questions. So one is like, how intense in advance of like getting into Augusta before the tournament, how intense was your like anti-COVID process? You must have been just wearing a plastic bag.
Yeah. Because
if you get any hint of it, you're out. Like, you can't, this is the dream.
I know.
And I would imagine they didn't have like if you get COVID, come back next year.
Yeah, I heard Paul Casey say that he stopped sending his kids on play dates for like 2 weeks before.
Yeah.
He's like, no one's allowed to leave the house.
I mean, the smart thing for me, I mean, I wouldn't call it smart, but like, I kind of wanted it like 4 weeks out. Like, not that I was going out trying to get it.
Oh, to get antibodies.
If you get it then you know you're going to be, so then you know you wouldn't get it Masters week, because that was the greatest fear of mine. Like, the most nervous I was all week was sitting in the hour that it took them to process the sample, sitting and waiting for my negative result to come back. Like, that was more nerve-wracking waiting to get that result back than it was, you know, getting prepared for the first tee shot.
Yeah, starting the first tee.
That was, you know, people could ask me, what was the most nervous you were all week at Augusta? I'd tell them, waiting for a negative COVID test to come back.
Did you have a chat? Did you?
That would scare me so much, because that's so much out of your control. At least like a 5-footer, like, it's your fault. But like, getting COVID is just like, it's the epitome of a bad bounce. I don't use that.
Yeah.
<It's> terrible. Just cut me out. I'm done.
Put a fork in me. Did you have a chance throughout the week to catch up with some of the other amateurs and kind of compare experiences? Such an emphasis on watching the Masters and seeing the amateurs, because everyone's like, oh, I wish I was good at golf.
Yeah, normally the amateurs do spend more time with each other just because of the crow's nest. Like, that's where we all hang out and sort of chat and that. But really the only opportunity we had was at the amateur dinner, which was awesome. I mean, it was like the fastest paced dinner ever. Like, it started at like 7:15 and went till 8:30, and it was like three courses, and there was like speeches, and it was like, it was so quick, but it was like action packed. So Trevor Immelman was the guest speaker. He competed as an amateur and won the tournament as well. So he spoke about his experiences. We had a guy, John Carr, who was one of the members. He sort of emceed it, and he had a lot of great stories. His dad had played it three times, I think, as an amateur. And so, yeah, it was a really awesome experience. Like, Mike Davis from the USGA was there, so we were chatting to him and all the other members. There was like 10 or 15 members there. It was like a really cool experience. And they had a statistic which was I found really cool, was that of the Masters winners, a third of them competed in the tournament as an amateur, which is pretty crazy. So, like, you think about, obviously it's helped by the fact that Tiger, you know, won five, you know, Mickelson 4, and, you know, Nicklaus 6, and whatever. But, like, overall of the Masters champions, a third of them competed as an amateur, which is, like, you know, when you're standing in that room with five other guys, amateurs, you're like, geez, like, one of these guys, you know, hopefully me, but there's a good chance one of these guys will win the Masters. That's pretty cool.
Did you spoke to, I don't know if you know, like, Curtis Luck or anyone, like any other Aussie amateurs that have spent the week there? I don't know if you know Curtis at all.
I know Curtis really well.
So had you spoke to him, and he kind of given you a heads up of what to expect?
Yeah, we actually played a practice round because he qualified for the US Open at Wingfoot. So we played a practice round there with Adam Scott, actually, and Ryo Ishikawa. So that was really cool. But yeah, Curtis obviously had a lot of tips. He did quite well as well. He made the cut. He didn't get low am. He just said his main thing was just enjoy it. Enjoy it, mate. Don't worry about how you play. Just enjoy the experience. So, he didn't really have too much advice on how to play the golf course or anything like that. He just said, really just enjoy the week.
Did you ever have a moment where you were like on the grounds or in the structures of Augusta or somewhere around it where you caught yourself feeling like comfortable or like at home? Were you ever like, whoa, wait a minute, like, I don't like this, all of a sudden is feeling kind of normal, like, and do you know what I'm talking about, like when you're in some amazing experience and then you're just like, oh yeah, this is like, you know, normal, this is Lucas's life, no big deal.
Yeah. 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 Sitting in the crow's nest, like literally the only one in the crow's nest, laying down, getting ready to bed, go to bed. And like, you're sitting there and you're like, there's not too many people that have been in this position. I'm just sort of sitting on my bed, trying to get to sleep. But yeah, there was obviously some moments where really comfortable, and the membership and the tournament, they do a really good job at trying to make you feel comfortable. But yeah, you definitely have to pinch yourself sometimes. The fact that what I got to experience, there's so few people that have ever done that. I mean, it's pretty.
And so you're playing, you play Wingfoot. You obviously, it's your first time playing in a major, maybe playing in a super televised tournament with so the best golfers in the world. What did you learn at Wingfoot? And you're like, I'm going to do Augusta a little differently. You know what I mean? Like you must've had, it was like a dry run for Augusta. Like, what were you like, you know, don't wear the striped shirt. Yeah. Like, what did you learn?
Only you would make it about fashion.
Yeah. For me, Wingfoot, like you said, was a bit of a trial run. I mean, trial run at the US Open, but it was a little bit to learn how to deal with a major championship was important. So I definitely felt like I tried to over prepare at Wingfoot. I kind of made the mistake that I could see everyone sort of doing, hitting too many shots around the green, getting worried about, you know, missing it here, missing it there. And so by the time I think I got there on Saturday evening, I walked 9 with my caddy and played 18 Sunday, 18 Tuesday. And then I was like, okay, I got to play 9 Wednesday. And so, like, I just burnt myself out prior to the week at Wingfoot, which was like, I played decent on the front 9. I think round 1, I shot like even par on the front 9. And then I had like 10 over on the back. So I just ran out of steam at round 1 and at Wingfoot. And so that was definitely something I took away and didn't do at Augusta.
There was some part of Wingfoot that was just exhausting. And even though it's a relatively flat golf course, there's some part of it that's just like, you're going to be exhausted even just after. So I wear this whoop strap and, you know, it tells you like the most strenuous day I've ever had in my life. I've been wearing it for a year. I've hiked mountains. I've done all sorts of, I've stayed up for 24 hours. The hardest thing I ever did was play 18 at Wingfoot. No joke. It was 21.5. And granted, I had a lot more strokes than you did, but it was Labor Day and it was just,
I believe that.
It was shocking. And I didn't even carry my own bag. Bo did.
I 100% believe that. It's the mental energy, I think. It's just like, it's such a grind. I mean, every shot you're just thinking, okay, don't do this, don't do that. You're mentally just, and the green complexes as well. Like, you're having to think so much about where, I mean, it's so complex, that golf course. For, like you said, a flat, easy kind of walk, it just strains the hell out of you.
Maybe if you go play Wingfoot again, you should just, instead of like doing any practice rounds or even going to the range, you should just bang your head against the nearest like wall and then just tee off and just see what happens. Just like forget everything.
I think I probably would have played better if I did that.
Yeah. I mean, look.
16 over or something for 2 rounds.
Look, I'm a mental coach. I don't charge. And I also take no responsibility for the results. But Stuart, you got any more questions?
Two more questions. Number one, what was the best thing that you bought in the pro shop that you still look at and you're like, yeah, I'm glad I got that? And number two, I mean,
let me go grab it.
We haven't even really spoke about the kind of
What's the COVID setup here? You got a putting green in the hotel room? What's going on?
What have we got here?
I don't know. I'm just sort of, well, I've got a bed that's actually up against a wall, but that gives me a little bit more extra space because they put 2 beds in the room that I'm in, which is strange. But
you're going to have a visitor.
Put the bed up.
It's in case he wants to move around.
Yeah, in case I get sick of that bed, I can just sleep on the other one. All right, so this is my favorite item from the pro shop. Ooh. So this is a needlepoint golf belt, Amen Corner. So it's like a scene of Amen Corner. So there's the 11th green.
11.
There's the 12th hole. And there's 13 there, I think. Yeah. So it's like needlepoint belt, but like it's like a scene of Amen Corner. It's pretty damn cool. That was probably my favorite thing I bought.
That is. Can I ask, Lucas? It's not a cheap belt, right? Yeah. Oh, he's frozen. The question killed him. He's like, don't. Lucas, you're frozen. No.
Nah, he's literally can't compute. He just looked his belt one more time. He's like, this belt is so cool.
His accountant just emailed him and was like, stop with the belt, dude. It's amazing. Like, imagine how hard would it be to create a belt that, like, is one image the entire way around. I mean, I know a little bit about things. That's not easy.
The thing is, can you actually wear it out in public, though? Or can you wear it to a golf course? Because sometimes I wear my Cypress belt and people go, oh, Cypress Point, huh? And I'm like,
I'm back. Sorry. Not sure what happened there.
Wait, what happens when you wear your Cypress belt, Stu?
People are like, oh, Cypress Point, huh? And I'm like, yeah. And I don't actually play it. I'm like,
you're like, yeah, have you been? Tell me all about it. The belt looks amazing, Lucas.
Dude, that belt,
I asked you how much it was, and you broke up.
To answer the question, I think it was 100.
And
like that's okay. One thing.
Okay. You get.
I don't know how much the internet wants me to tell you how expensive it is.
It really doesn't.
Augusta National, yeah, like, it's no, this is not happening.
They send you like snail mail tabs, but they also are keeping track of you digitally. I mean, the fact that it starts with 100 is unbelievable. That's very cool. Very cool.
And, ends with 1,000.
Priceless. That's so crazy. Go ahead, Stu. What else?
Oh, just last question, unless you get, I don't know if you get anything else to add, Eric. My question would definitely be like what your biggest takeaway. Like I say, you've kind of got all this time now to sit back and reflect on it all. What's been the biggest takeaway? What's been the biggest thing that you keep going back to?
I think playing with some really good players. I mean, I played with obviously Xander and Patrick Cantlay. I mean, they're two of the best young guys in golf at the moment. I kind of saw that my game actually wasn't that far away from them. Like I could hit all the same shots they could hit. It's just that they're a little straighter. Like my short game is actually, I realize now it's pretty solid. Short game and putting is pretty solid. I just got to dial in my ball striking a bit more. And so that's sort of where I'll be sort of focusing the rest of my attention for the near future. Because I do think I want to make sure I give golf everything I've got and make sure if I step away from the competitive side of the game, I want to know that I gave it everything and I just, you know, wasn't good enough. And if I can know that, then I won't ever regret, you know, not trying to play pro golf and doing it that way. So yeah, the next year for me will be me sort of keep competing. And then if I feel like my game's in good shape, I'm probably going to try the qualifying schools, probably in Europe and Japan. And just try and get a card somewhere in hopefully one of those two places and then turn pro. But if that doesn't work out, then I think eventually at some point the golf course architecture side of things definitely will be part of the rest of my life. It's just, you know, hopefully it's 20, 30 years away and I have a good career in golf playing, but it could be closer. We'll see.
That must have been such a huge confidence boost, because going into that, you would have no idea how you stack up against the best of the best. And now you're getting to see the best of the best at the best of the best. So when they're really trying to be on top of their game. Comparing your game to theirs must have been a huge confidence boost for you.
It's definitely, and it was a valuable experience for sure. That was probably the most, the biggest takeaway was just understanding how the best of the best play when you're playing on the same golf course as them. And, you know, my scores weren't great. But relative to how I know I can play, I know I played poorly. So I felt like if I played well, you know, 2 under par each day for an 800 par total wouldn't have been out of the question. That would have been in the top sort of 15. So, it's just kind of getting my game a little sharper, particularly the long game, because I just didn't have a good week with the driver or irons.
Yeah, did you see Dylan Fratelli actually was interesting to me, like for a guy who's not, you know, super big, focused a little bit on speed and top 10, no problem. And went from like, I think it was like 1/60th in driving distance to like 15th or something. Just,
yeah.
Is that at all taking part of your game? Or do you care at all? Are you like trying to get to 315?
I hit it pretty long, but I mean, length is a huge advantage in golf. And so I was probably in the top 30 or 40% lengthwise in that field. So I certainly wasn't the longest guy out there, but I was long enough. I think the biggest thing for me was hitting it straighter. I mean, I hit 2 or 3 fairways in the first round. I think it was 8 in the second round. So I hit it a lot better in the second round, but my iron play was really poor. I think for the week I hit maybe like, I think it was like 54% of greens and 49% of fairways or something like that. It was pretty poor. So
what do you attribute that to?
I think it's just learning to play ball striking wise, just learning to play under pressure. Because under normal conditions, my ball striking is fine. But yeah, the major golf experience definitely found the faults in my swing and in my game. So yeah, I just need to hopefully get a bit more experience playing under pressure and in contention at amateur tournaments, and then work my way up and get back into some majors, hopefully.
That's the thing. You have roughly about 270 shots for the week, and almost you have to find that for every 270 of those shots has to be the best shot you're going to hit. And you have to be mentally in that zone for every single one of those shots. There's not a lot of room for error, you know?
No, you're right.
So the last round you played was in the Masters at Augusta. Where's the next round? And are you just going to like rip it apart? Should you just go play like a 6,000 yard, like 8-9 hole, 18 hole course and just be like, what's the plan?
I get out of quarantine on December 1. I've got New South Wales Golf Club in Sydney lined up.
Yes. Have you played there before?
So
yeah,
I've played it a couple times, so it'll be good to go there. It's probably one of the most beautiful golf experiences you could ever imagine. Did you play it, Eric?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome. And Stu, have you played it as well?
I think I'm actually going there in the new year for the first time.
Ah, awesome. Yeah, it's such an awesome, beautiful. You know, it's up in it. So that'll be great, sort of back getting back to golf. And yeah, I feel like it'll be interesting how my game holds up, because I mean it's going to be over 2 weeks since I've really hit a golf shot when I step out there. So I'm not sure I've got the highest expectations, but we'll see what happens.
When they were like, you have to do quarantine, could you, like, maybe not you particularly, but like, could one be like, give me another room, I need a simulator, I need this and that? Could you, or no? Or is it just like, what hotel are you in? Like, and who pays for the hotel? Do you?
Yeah. So I'm in, it's actually really beautiful. Have a look at that out my window. So I'm in Darling Harbour, Sydney. Lovely.
Is that the Novotel?
Yeah.
Sick.
It is the Novotel. Yeah.
Thanks, so dude. Good eyes. Nice. It's kind of creepy.
I usually stay in the hotel next door, the Sofitel.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, it's just right there.
That one. Yeah.
I got a really nice room. Although the windows don't open and there's no balcony. So for 14 days, I can't breathe. But
you're not allowed to go. Or you can go for a walk.
No, I can't leave the, room. Like, so if you're a smoker, you cannot smoke for 14 days. So there's like smokers going crazy. So it used to be that you didn't have to pay, and then they brought in paying for it. Like,
yeah.
But fortunately, I booked my original ticket to return home before the date that they introduced compulsory paying. So I don't have to pay for my stay, which is nice. But it's normally $3,000 for the 2 weeks. Jeez. So it's a lot of money. And thankfully, I got out of that. But
that's almost as much as you spent at Augusta.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, do you have any idea how many belts I could have for this?
Wait, so do you do? Do you have like workout material? Do you have like resistance bands?
I do. I've got like a little area. I did a big workout last night. So there's my bed sort of folded, flipped up onto the wall. I've got a little, you know, foam roller and resistant bands and a little area that I've been stretching and stuff. So, I mean, I can do a little bit of stuff, but I mean, basically I'm just locked in a room for 14 days.
Look, I don't like feel bad for you, but I think I would be going crazy. Like I legit think I would be going crazy.
I mean, I've done a couple of these podcasts now. I'd say 72 hours I've been here, I'd say like 10 of the hours I've been on the phone talking to people on podcasts or just talking to friends and stuff. So
yeah.
I'm trying my best to.
You could put cameras in a room like that, put Eric in there for 2 weeks, not allow him to move, and turn it into a movie. And it would be hilarious and sad and horrific. And all happy and all of the above.
That's crazy. So can you open the door, or what happens if you open the door to the hallway?
So there's a door there. I can open it. They drop meals off, food, because I don't have a kitchen either. Like if I had a kitchen, it'd be great. I'd just cook all the time.
Yeah.
But there's a door that they drop off food. I haven't heard it yet, but breakfast should be here sometime soon. They just knock on the door and then they leave because they don't want to risk kind of getting infected if I'm infected. But if I leave the room, there's a security guard at the elevator. So, I mean, they don't basically let you. You basically, they advise you to not walk into the hallways So right. I really haven't. I had a COVID test yesterday.
Go ahead.
And so I had to get out of the room and do that. But like I stepped like a meter out of my room. Like it wasn't like I was going somewhere.
Can you order items like from a store?
Yes. Yes. So I ordered groceries and got some fruit and like chocolate and stuff. And then, but I was considering, I was trying to find a PlayStation 5, but they are out of stock everywhere.
Good luck.
Yeah.
So I couldn't find one of them. So that was going to be my, like, that was the plan the whole time. Get a PS5 and just like game for 2 weeks. But unfortunately, that's not going to happen. So
and you haven't set up the putting. You haven't started putting in the room yet.
No.
That's going to happen like on day 11.
I was chipping. No, day zero, I was chipping.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So day zero, I was chipping, but I don't know. I haven't, putting's like, I'm a good putter and I just like, don't practice putting. So
yeah, I'll never say that.
If that was me chipping in the room, then you would have windows that opened because it'd all be smashed. Well,
that was why I stopped chipping. Actually, I was chipping on day zero, and then I stopped because I was scared I was going to put one through the window.
So, amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just. But the thing is, you could put them through the window, and they wouldn't know for like 2 weeks, and you could just. You'd be like, "No, it was like that when I got here."
Yeah, exactly. Some guy must have been hitting balls in the harbor.
Yeah, some crazy guy. I don't know. He clearly didn't play the Masters like me. Anyway, have a good trip, guys.
That actually reminds me of my story in St. Andrews. So I studied for 6 months at the University of St. Andrews. And my room opened up at a window, small window that faced the golf course. But the golf course was 150 yards through the window. And the day I arrived there, I looked out the window. It was a stunning view across like the town. It was beautiful, West Sands and everything. And I looked at it, I was like, I could hit a golf shot out that window.
And then, sure, you want to complete this story?
Yeah, no,
you could have a lawsuit in your hands.
I waited till my last night there in case anything went wrong, because I was leaving at 7 a.m. the next morning. And I had a few friends around and I hit a shot through the window out onto the 18th green. So I had friends that were like, calling FaceTime from the green, and they're like, yeah, it's landed. So we went down there and I two-putted it for three in the middle of the night. So that was I don't think I'll be doing that, but if it opened, I probably would have been blasting them into Darling Harbour. Would have had to get some of those biodegradable golf balls there. But yeah, that was probably the most fun I had in St. Andrews when I was there.
That's awesome, man. Well, I mean, thank you so much, Lucas, for your time. We could do another podcast tomorrow too.
Yeah, I got unlimited time, Eric.
Yeah.
Don't even bother thanking me for it.
No, that's cool, man. What a cool experience. And you know, I'm excited to catch up with you again soon. Hopefully you guys can play some golf together soon.
Yeah, finally. Yeah.